Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Today we have Michael Bloomfield of the Mellman Group. Very smart guy, went to the University of Michigan. We sat down in his conference room, which did not have an inch to spare. It was just covered in different campaigns that they have worked on. Michael got his last job was political director of AIPAC, and as you all know, a very powerful lobbying group in Washington, D.C., and now he's at the Mellman Group. And it is always very interesting for people in our business to sit down and talk to pollsters. And if you listen carefully to what Michael's saying, he really has some insight into how issues and topics get framed and just some important things to think about in our business. It was really enjoyable to sit down with him in his office in Washington, D.C., and I hope you enjoy the interview. Michael Bloomfield. I'm sitting here with Michael Bloomfield from the Mellman Group, and we're sitting in your conference room in downtown Washington, D.C., in Georgetown, and I'm looking at your conference room, and I see Governor Granholm, Senator Boxer, Steny Hoyer, Pat Quinn. Kerry pulls off Iowa upset, vote no, Proposition 226. The Mellman Group has worked on a lot of campaigns.
This shows that we need a new, updated look to get some more recent campaign posters up there.
Well, you've run out of room. That's the problem. And there is a picture of the president.
Much better way to spin that.
There is not an inch available, and you do have one of President Obama behind you, so that's good. But Michael, so you've gone from AIPAC to now to the Mellman Group. How long have you been here at the Mellman Group?
I was going to say it's almost 20 years. I should not use round numbers as a pollster, but maybe 18 or 19.
Okay. And then and you were political director for AIPAC?
Yes.
And how long were you at AIPAC?
10 years.
Wow. And what was that like?
AIPAC, well, I'd worked on the Hill before. And
okay, why don't we back up? I was going to start off with, so you've run a Boston Marathon a number of times.
No, I've run a number of marathons, Boston only once, which actually was my worst marathon, but that's a different interview.
And did you qualify for Boston?
I did qualify for Boston. Wow, Philadelphia is my favorite city because I qualified there.
And what's your best marathon time?
3:28 and a few seconds.
Wow.
I needed to hit 3:30, so I can say my wife was at the finish line going, uh-oh, where is he?
And you made it.
Yes.
With just under 2 minutes to spare. How many times have you done Boston? Once?
Only once. I did it in the worst heat they've ever had, though they may have broken it since then. And I had my worst time, which I will not repeat on the air.
How hot was it?
There was a person who died, actually. So, wow. And it sort of like put things in perspective, but it was the only marathon other than my first where I ended up walking for part of it. And funny story, I'm walking by Fenway. My knees just gave out on me. I had bad knee problems. Had knee surgery before that to run Boston. Walking by Fenway, the most depressing thing. I'm a big sports fan. Wanted to run by Fenway in a sprint. And there's some guy looks at me and goes, just one of the spectators goes, keep going. You got him just where you want him.
Running a marathon in the heat must be brutal.
Don't plan to do it again.
So are you a Red Sox fan?
No. Just
baseball
a sports fan.
Okay.
Sports fan.
All right.
Cleveland fan, actually.
Okay. So where'd you grow up?
Ohio. Cleveland, Ohio, then Toledo, Ohio.
Okay. And you went to University of Michigan?
Yes.
Okay. What did you do after college?
Well, during college, I'd taken time off to work on a campaign, ran a campaign, state rep campaign in Toledo.
Okay.
And did that in 1980, which is a mistake, like running Democratic campaigns in
the Reagan landslide
in 1994, or I hope for Republicans running campaigns right now. It was not a good year in the Reagan landslide, but also worked on the Hill, so I took time off from school two different times, one to run this campaign and one to work on the Hill.
How'd your parents feel about that?
They were supportive. They were supportive, yeah.
So you would take a semester off, you worked on this campaign, and then you went back to school after that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What made you think of doing that?
Once you get bit by the bug.
How'd you get bit by the bug?
I came to, through some connections looking for a summer job, came to Washington. Actually, as I say, it's going to sound like some sort of made-up story, but wanted to volunteer, wanted to do something on the Hill, didn't know anything about the Hill, really.
Okay.
And got some connections, got a job there working for free, which I then parlayed into an internship and then parlayed into actually coming back as for working a year on the Senate on foreign policy issues. Paid almost nothing, but I was paid, which was important. And you get bit by the bug, and then I'm going, I want to work on campaigns and, you know, looking at all of that. I actually wanted to work for another, it would have been another ill-fated effort, but I wanted to work for Ted Kennedy, Senator Kennedy's presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. Didn't find a job I really wanted there that I felt was up to what I wanted to do. So I went and did a state rep campaign. Either way, I ended up on a would have been on a losing campaign, but at least I got to manage the campaign. So.
And what was the first internship on the Hill? What was your first political job?
It was working for Ted Kennedy.
Okay.
Looking back, I would not advise anybody to do that, but I met someone who knew someone who said, I can get you a job like working in the mailroom, and parlayed that into, like I say, a paid job on foreign policy at some point. So.
Well, that's good. Why would you not recommend that?
Because I would say go to the House side, go in a smaller office.
Oh, okay.
You know, I ended up getting lucky, but it was sort of, what they say, stupid lucky. So.
Okay. Oh, so that's interesting. So you're saying go to the House side where there's less staff and more opportunity for you as a young intern to do interesting work.
And at that point, Senator Kennedy was looked at as sort of the presumptive next president. This was when Carter was in the pits as far as his numbers.
Yep.
And it was looked like, I was always say I was there at his most powerful moment, because everyone knew whenever he ran, he would win. There was no question about that. And I say this so many quotes, no question. Yes. But it's just like, this guy can be president whenever he decides to do it.
Right.
So, you know, before that, he was still working up to that point. And after that, and he lost, then the shine was off a little bit. So I was there really the moment where I can say, being an intern at Ted Kennedy's office, you could call anybody for anything. They don't know you're an intern. They'll go, yes, sir.
That's great. So you get out of the University of Michigan, and you already have political experience. You've already had, ran a campaign. And so what do you do then?
So worked on the Hill then for my home state senator, Howard Metzenbaum.
Okay.
And then worked for my college state senator, Don Riegel. Worked on international trade issues for him for a few years. Then actually went off and to make some money working in a family business, investment business.
Okay.
And then...
In D.C. or back in
D.C.?
Ohio?
In D.C.
In D.C. Okay.
When you live in Toledo, Ohio, and it's a family investment business, people don't want to invest in other parts of Ohio. They want to invest in places like Washington. And then got back into politics again through some things probably not worth going through here, but ended up at AIPAC and worked, you know, my way up to being political director there. I was there 10 years. And you were asking before the difference of AIPAC and here, and that's why I said, well, really, you have to look at what I did before then, too. It's just that AIPAC is... we go between calling it nonpartisan or really bipartisan. And so all of a sudden, it's the only time in my life where I'm just constantly, or I shouldn't say the only time, it just was always dealing with Republicans as equally as Democrats.
Right.
And it is just a different mindset. And I was there, I mentioned 1980, I'm showing my age here, but, you know, just talk about important times. I was, you know, ran a Democratic campaign in 1980, not good. And in fact, it was the only year one of my two hometowns of Toledo had a Republican congressman since Eisenhower. So still to this day, it's the only time a Republican has ever won was that one year. But at AIPAC, I was there for 1994, which as a Democrat was probably, in a way, a safer place to be than if I had been on a campaign or doing something else political. But it was fascinating. I mean, I was there, you know, at AIPAC. We dealt a lot with people like Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich and Mitch McConnell. And dealt with Democrats, too. But that was part of what I was. And when you said, what's the difference being at AIPAC, that's the difference.
Okay. And what were some of the big issues you had to confront during your time as political director at AIPAC?
Well, when you say as political director, AIPAC as an organization, there were a lot of issues, some which, you know, obviously I say better or worse, I'll say for worse, obviously a lot of the challenges for Israel continue.
Yep.
And the same security challenges we had then, there were, you know, different things. The Gulf War. Yeah. I mean, they were there for, you know, numerous negotiations. I was in the Rose Garden for the signing of the peace agreement, and then the eventual dissipation of that,
right.
You know, over the year. So, yeah, I mean, talk about important things. I was there in the Rose Garden as, you know, some of us were the an AIPAC delegation when Clinton and Arafat and Rabin were there signing the agreement.
Wow.
But well, again, the challenges are seeing it fall apart and everything else that happened after that. But with the challenge for AIPAC also was that we were primarily, Jewish community still is primarily Democratic, and trying to stay positioned politically for with this very Democratic, I shouldn't say very, with a community, not the organization. The organization is rigorously bipartisan.
Right,
It works very hard to stay away. But the community, I mean, it's just a fact, is more Democratic than Republican.
Right.
And trying to stay, keep those same position when you have not only just so many upsets happening on E4, particularly so many upsets of Republicans over Democrats.
Right.
And make sure we had our, you know, what we were doing there is basically, I think the term is grassroots lobbying. I mean, what I hear, we would have our own way to describe it, but that's what it was. I mean, we were basically taking a community that was not always spread out all over the country, but doing our best to, you know, reach people who were elected in Idaho's and Montana, where the Jewish community is small, but finding other ways to get into, you know, the few people who are there and finding, you know, whether they were doing business there, whether there people who are just very concerned about the Middle East for other reasons or religious reasons that weren't, you know, Jewish reasons, but building up those connections. And that's what we did. And, you know, as the challenges in 94 were not just the issues themselves, but making sure we were strong in Congress.
And that grassroots network, was that the most effective way to move your issue on issues on the Hill, getting constituents and businesses in the districts?
Yes, I would say it's, when I say the most effective way, I guess everything plays a part. But yes, that is when I'm doing this now, because while we work on campaigns, we also do a lot of work with organizations trying to move an agenda on the Hill.
Right.
And having grassroots support is just
critical. Right.
And so, you know, here I'm a realist. Obviously, political money helps.
Right.
Being able to show, and I'm putting a plug-in for the polling industry, being able to show there's public support is something else.
Yep.
But the idea of the way one of the things about, actually with the money, it's not just the money. Think of it this way. If you're giving money to people, it's still the idea of the personal connection. And, you know, it's, to put it in sort of terms you can visualize, it's the idea of handing them the check as opposed to mailing it.
Yes.
Or wiring it. But the idea of being able to build up their relationship and, you know, when you're dealing with an issue, while the Middle East on one hand is very important and everyone elected office you would think would understand it, it is not something that if you're a congressman, you necessarily have to deal with all the time.
Right.
And I'll say since 9/11, I wasn't there for 9/11, you know, obviously I'd say it became more of a national, you know, American issue that everyone would talk about it more, a little bit more domestic focus.
Yep.
But in general, foreign policy is never at the top of everyone's at the top of a congressman's list, unless they're on, say, the Foreign Affairs Committee or the, you know, the Armed Services Committee in the Senate or whatever it is. And so getting people who talk to them and get their time, and obviously money's a part of that, but talk to them and give them that, you know, that briefing, and this is the way AIPAC works, is much more important than anything we did as a our professional lobbyists, our paid people on the Hill, including me, going up there. It's the effective thing is to have the person with you or who goes on their own who actually, you know, lives near the congressman, knows congressman, or at least has a friend of a friend of a friend with the congressman.
And much easier to get a meeting when you're bringing a constituent to the meeting. How big is AIPAC? How many staff-wise?
They've, I think, doubled and tripled since I've been there. But I'm even though I am a donor, I'm not the expert on that, but it's much bigger.
How big was it when you, I'm just
approximate. When I was there, and I'm very rough numbers, you know, 100 people with offices around the country.
Big organization.
Most in Washington, but still offices, you know, we had like 7 offices around the country, including when I was there. I think we had an office in Missoula, Montana, which I don't know if they still do. But, and it's grown, and I will say part of this is, you know, really good work on their part.
Yep.
And I think, as I mentioned, 9/11, I think that got a lot of people more focused on these issues.
Yep. Well, just an incredible group and very effective. So you, what year did you leave AIPAC and come
99.
Here? 99, okay. And now you are here at the
Melbourne. You told me I didn't have to study for this. I actually remember these off the top of my
head. That's all right.
Well, surprised.
And now you're here at the Melbourne Group. And tell us about the Melbourne Group.
So we are what people would call a polling firm. And I say that because it's basically market research. Now we do roughly, you know, half of what we do, and obviously I'm speaking in revenue terms here, is, you know, is on the ballot.
Yep.
So whether it's an initiative or a campaign or working with, you know, that it's something where we are, you know, our main goal is to, you know, vote X, not Y.
Yes.
And then we have, I'd say, about, you know, another third or more that is working in the public policy arena, or in some way doing public opinion, often political, but, you know, maybe on, let's say, getting more attention for an issue or helping someone figure out how to frame an issue. And, you know, often, as I said, there's still a, let's say, a win-lose component, because the ultimate goal may be to get something passed on the Hill. So still there, you know, now some of those efforts can go on for long, long time, but some of them, you know, are really just, we want to get votes for, again, you know, whatever bill this is, or votes against another bill.
Right.
And then we do some that I would call is really straight market research, either for, you know, as we say, you know, selling toothpaste,
yep,
or often selling organizations. Have done quite a bit, which really overlaps those last two categories, where we do, you know, helping groups raise money, you know, using their, doing market research on their donors or prospective donors. Now, often they are political-oriented groups, but sometimes they're, you know, we do work for universities, do work for nonprofits that are not that political, and just helping them maximize, and this is what polling's about, really. We always say it's, everyone looks at it, that's why I like to say market research, not polling, because people look at polling and say, well, it's all about the prediction. We're not really in the prediction business at all. People like to do that on, you know, CNN or whatever it is, but really what we're in is the strategy, messaging, and probability business. Probability, telling people, you know, here's how people react most likely. Here's the information we can give them that will change the way they react. And often the way we describe what we do is we're trying to intervene in their decision-making process. So if they're of a mind to do X, and we may want them to either buy a certain product, or our clients, I should say, should,
right,
or, like I say, go to a certain university, or think better of an organization or an industry, you know, a company, whatever the company is doing, let's say in a given state, they're facing regulatory problems, they may want to just try to burnish their image. But they may also be saying, we need to build more support for something we are doing, or tamp down opposition.
Got it. So with the university, what's important to the alumni, or what are prospective students?
I say both, and more than that,
okay.
The question, you know, we usually call these internal, they're still all internal audiences.
Okay.
But trying to build a brand.
What's important to them,
yeah,
and what are they looking for? Okay. Interesting. And obviously then you also do a lot of campaigns, a lot of campaign work. We're coming up on the midterms, very unique times that we're in now.
I would say that is definitely true. Unfortunately, I say that, but it is an amazing time.
It's really incredible, and we've already seen some upsets. In our state, in Connecticut, we saw a 20-year-plus incumbent get beat by a woman first time running. She was a first-term school board member and tapped into the Me Too movement, and nobody saw it coming. And she won. It was really, it's really quite something.
I mean, here, some of the things from our perspective, and I guess thinking more, because you started.
And I know you don't want to talk about, I mean, I know you have clients in this, so you're not allowed to, this.
No, but looking at it, just in the context you were asking before about the sort of the, let's say, the business or the industry.
Yes.
Things we've seen. One is we have Democrats crawling out of the woodwork to run, which is a great thing.
Yes.
And it's interesting, it actually.
Good for the Melman Group.
Yes. But while it's not something that, it's not a sign that Democrats are going to win, but it is often, again, it's one of these correlation causation differences. There is a correlation between these years when you have, and it's worked against us in other years, where Republicans are all, you know, they have Republican primaries that are very, very contested. And despite what any candidate might say, including the ones I work for, you never want a primary. It's always easier not to have that added race. The people who say, like, there's a benefit, oh, yeah, I'm glad we had a primary to toughen us up. That may be a small benefit, but no one would wish for a primary. But we, as a party, are seeing the sign of the Democratic enthusiasm is reflected in the idea of how many multi-candidate races we did. And not, and I say did because a lot of the primaries are over. And I would say this is not just our firm. Every firm would say this. Just busier primary season, because there are just so many, not just one person running against, you know, challenging incumbent, but places where you're running against a Republican incumbent in a Republican district, and you have six or seven or, you know, four or five serious Democratic candidates who raise serious money out there really battling out the issues. Again, I don't think it's a plus for the party, but it ends up being one of those signs where you go, this ends up usually reflecting Democratic enthusiasm that pays off in November. And the other place we've seen it is we've, you know, a lot more of these special elections. We worked in a couple of these, even places, and some, you know, we were working like for the DCCC. I mentioned Montana. I do a lot of work there in the special House race there. And while we didn't win, and our polling showed we wouldn't win, but is that what we did see is that, and we saw this in every race, I mean, just look at the public data, in every place, the Democrat was finishing, if it was a place where, you know, Hillary or Democrats historically only got to, you know, 45, we were getting to 48, still not enough to win, but often finishing on average like 8 to 9 points higher than the Democratic performance had been. In some of those places, we were able to take Republican seats, you know, but in some way just made them much closer. But it really is, and it's why you have in that Ohio, in my home state, though much more south from where I grew up, but the district outside Columbus, which was a reliable Republican seat, in fact, had been held at one point decades ago by John Kasich, now the outgoing governor, but would be go, you know, multi-double digits. I mean, like, not just 10, but sometimes 20 points for Republicans. We almost won. Now, we ended up losing by one. Not a race I worked on, but it's just, that's the sort of sign of the
times.
That's
incredible.
So.
Wow. I'm sure you've been asked this question 50 times, but while we're talking about it, so the last presidential race, you know, was the polling off, or it was a bit of a surprise, or...
Wait, was there a problem with the polling?
What was the...
President Clinton seems to think it's... Oh, no.
Why were we all surprised?
That's a good way to put it. Why were we all surprised? No, I'm saying, as opposed to saying, you know, the polling was all off. There were definitely, and I still have people to this day, and I was just on a vacation with one of them, where I'm talking about not people in politics, but someone said, you know, we're going to take the House, you know, Democrat, and I start talking, they go... He didn't realize Trump was going to win. Don't listen to him, you know? And why I think the where the perceptions were off, it wasn't so much the polling, actually. It was a lot of, there were a lot of assumptions that places like Wisconsin and Michigan, where if you look back, there was almost no polling. And so, you know, you look back and...
Assumptions were made.
And in some of the places, you know, no question, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and again, I want to be clear just because I don't mind talking about my polls, but these were just public polls, reliable public polls. We're showing the Pennsylvania race, the presidential race in Pennsylvania and Ohio, close, but Hillary ahead. And there were some maybe that showed Trump ahead, but it was always looked like, okay, you know, Democrats can pick off one or two of those. And then in North Carolina, where I do a lot of work, the race kept getting close, but there was still this idea of, okay, Hillary can hold on. And what you saw there was the governor in that state, Republican Governor McCrory, was running behind. He ended up finishing, so it was so close that it was like the presidential election 2000, he wasn't declared the loser till like a month later. So it was whether, you know, it was like less than 1%. Recounts kept going on. The polling had shown, you know, a little more Democratic. That's a place where maybe the polling was a little bit misleading.
Okay.
But in general, a lot of this was there were states that people weren't doing polling in, and there wasn't much out there.
Which
and
is a bad reflection on the campaigns that weren't doing the polling in those states.
Well, I would say if you read some of the, you know, I'm one of the many people in politics who like to read those tell-all books afterwards, you know, about the campaign. One of the things that came out was in Ohio, the Clinton campaign, which had, I want to be clear, I didn't know at that point during the campaign. They knew Ohio they were going to lose and decided it was worth spending money to stay in there and keep competing, lest they pull people and resources and put them elsewhere. And this is in the book Shattered Glass. And they're better off competing there and wasting those resources in a place they knew they were going to, that they already knew they couldn't win, than having the story that comes out of Clinton gives up in Ohio. And then in places like Michigan, they were worried that the more they worked there, that they were actually hurting themselves, that Hillary was not, that persuasion wasn't the best thing to do there. I think that was, in retrospect, the wrong decision, but it was actually made with a lot more data than we realized then. They were making a calculated decision not to engage too much there. But the rest of us were, and you said, and I said it was a good way to ask the question, why did we have the perception that we were, you know, that things were all so shocking? It was the idea of Wisconsin, the group I work with, we did just talk about foreshadowing, doing work for a group I'm working with still, a long longtime client, works on manufacturing issues, trying to build up support for manufacturing issues, and a lot of that's trade issues as well, which are very hot right now. And we did focus groups in two primary states. We're looking at swing states that might be important in November. So we do this early in the year, we do Ohio, we do Wisconsin. And some people said, well, you know, if you're doing Wisconsin, that's not really a swing state. And Democrats said to me, you know, said, we said here, well, really, if we're in trouble in Wisconsin, we really are in trouble. Turned out we picked right. And I don't want to say we thought it would be as close as it was, but again, very, very little polling was ever done there. So it wasn't like people said, oh, we're wrong because look at all these polls. It was went, oh, wait a sec, Wisconsin was supposed to be Democratic and no one had really done anything there to look at it.
Right. So what have there been a lot of changes in your industry in the past 10 years? What has – I mean, we've seen
huge.
Really?
Yeah.
So we've seen these automated polls a lot and – they don't seem to be that accurate for the most part. Or it's hard to say. In some of the ones that just came out in Connecticut recently, you know, the disparity was just too great.
Well, the IVR polls, as they're called, there are, you know, a lot of limitations with them.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, it is not like the, you know, the technology or the methodology means they can't be right.
Yep.
But it's just the limitations because of laws that have been passed that actually. It didn't even exist when I started working here, and I say only done this 20 years. There are people, my partner, you know, the head of the company, has been doing this, you know, 35 some years. But it's that, you know, there's laws that people are doing those IVR polls can't call cell phones.
Oh.
You can imagine that's become an increasing, was less of a problem in the 80s.
Right, but now so you're only calling landlines.
Not us, we only do live caller.
Right, no, I know that.
Or I should say we use that methodology for some data collection, but not for actual interview polls.
Okay, so if you can't call cell phones, you're skewing much older if you're doing an automated poll.
Right,
and I mean, we have never, my wife pointed this out, we have never had a babysitter who has had a landline. And we've had babysitters for 15 years. And so it goes to show you that.
Well, I mean, so the changes in the industry have been, I mean, first there was, you know, cell phones have gone from something that existed, and since I've been here for 20 years, and I'm trying to think of when, but cell phones, the internet, all of this, on one hand, makes it harder to reach people on the traditional methods that we used before, say, 2000. But being here, you know, as we go into the 21st century, it's also opened up. And the big issue for us is just being able to reach people.
Okay.
And it is, you know, the common question is, why do people ever stay on? I can't believe people stay on for these 20-minute interviews. They do.
I love to get
them. Oh, see?
Great.
Thank you.
Well.
I have another podcast.
So in certain states, you can't call cell phones, though.
No, we can because we are not, we are researchers.
Okay.
The do not call list, all of this now, it does affect us and makes it our life harder.
Okay.
But it is, those laws are for people selling things.
Okay, so if you're doing research or a survey or whatever it may be, that's okay.
Right.
Okay.
As long as you can say
you're not selling.
And
you're not on a do not call list.
Selling and giving.
Okay.
In other words, obviously selling is also saying, will you give money to the organization?
Right, okay.
No, we're just doing this for research purposes.
So that's been a big change. What else has changed?
I mean, well, and also there's opportunities that come with that. So now we're doing things online that used to be when you did something online, while people have had, while computers have been around and the, you know, internet's been around for decades.
Yeah.
Not too many decades, but decades. The idea was it was, you know, it has gone from something that was not only, let's say, a selective and maybe elite to be more commonplace to now it's pretty much ubiquitous. I mean, you know, are there places that some people that don't have some way to reach them either on a smartphone or on a online? I'm sure there are some. We know, you know, they know the numbers. But as you say, they're increasingly people who are cutting the cord. And that means, you know, what they're doing, those are opening up. It opens up, or what happens is it opens up opportunities for us to do surveys, do focus groups online. Just have done qualitative boards, which are like chat rooms in a way, the old days, which I don't know if people still use them. But for research, it's great, as opposed to going to your home state of Connecticut and having to do focus groups, which I'm still a big believer in qualitative research. And we often do focus groups. I think they're great. Being in the room with someone is fantastic. The only way to really get to know how they think and what they're thinking.
Yep.
But we can also do things where we do something very quickly, get them online, recruit them. We're not traveling out. We're able to get a whole state's worth of people and either show them, as we have, you know, ads video ads, okay, or show them just material, give them material and information, and you are having a conversation. And sometimes we've done this, where we've done this over a week period. I'm hoping the fall we may be doing it for some, in those weren't direct campaigns, there were issues,
okay,
but doing it for some campaigns where we're, you know, on for 2 weeks and just hear what they are thinking, what, you know, get the information at what it's a way of asking just normal voters. And of course there is a little bit of a effect where they are more politically attuned because they're doing
yes
but you're still hearing what they're hear what they have found, what they're thinking, and also how they hear the information. We did this once for a campaign and initiative, and you know, we often talk about we're trying to figure out the best message. That's a lot of what this is about.
Yep.
Not just finding out something that works, but what is the single best message? Because in the world we live in, despite everyone think that there's 40 political ads or 40 advertisements they see for all these companies, it really is only one thing, especially in politics, that can get through to someone in such a cluttered environment. And you have to figure out what your one thing is going to be. I'd be very careful. And maybe if you have more money, you can do two. But even then, you want them linked. We found out that in ad we had been running, it wasn't just the ad that wasn't working as well, but in fact people were totally misunderstanding what this initiative was. Just misunderstanding it. Not like, oh, they don't realize how great it is, but just going, they had it confused with another initiative. There was an education measure. There were two of them on the ballot on different topics. They were sort of conflating them in their minds, and we realized we had to do a clarity campaign, not just persuasion, but explaining this is this one and here's what it does, because people had sort of lost it. And we get this from picking this up on these online groups,
that's
where they just start reciting to us what they're hearing. And again, it's not like they're saying, oh, we don't like, let's say, your candidate. We're going, no, you should like them. Let me tell you good stuff. This is like, they just totally don't realize, you know, what this measure is at all. So we were trying to persuade them. And in fact, we had to first just explain the facts to them.
And if you hadn't done that, you would have had no idea. How big of audience do you have for like an online focus group? How many people do you ideally
You can do...
like for this group, how many people did you...
Yeah, what was it? We did... that one was like 50 people.
Okay.
Often can do four different groups. You
okay.
know, just like we would do, I don't know if you, you know, do focus groups, your firm, you know, gets involved doing focus groups. When you do them, usually you're doing, you know, 8 to 10 in a room.
Right.
So here you can do more than that.
Wow.
But you still, the more people you have, the less you get to actually push them and actually read it and talk to them.
Okay.
You know, they're talking to you online. We're not doing something which we could do, but this is what I'm talking about, is not having them on the screen, sort of
okay.
in a Brady Bunch look where they're you're
okay.
asking questions.
Right, these
are things, and this is a benefit. You lose some of the personal interaction. What you gain is they're coming online when they can. So we tell them we're going to post a new, you know, something, either an ad or a paragraph of information or whatever in the afternoon, and they come on and
look at it and give you their comments.
Yeah, and so
how
they may be all at different times that they're coming on.
And how do you recruit them?
Well, it matters what different ways to recruit for different. Just so we would do any focus group. Some of them were if we're doing members, say if members of
right.
a union,
but let's say
we're
it's
using
not
their
members.
List. Oh, we have firms that you know work with.
Reach
us
out to the general public
yeah.
and get people.
Right.
Okay.
What we're doing is we're defining who they should get. We have a screener that they have to pass. In other words, we only want certain people there. If you're just like here, the easiest one to understand. If you're doing, you know, political groups, especially in the fall, you don't want to get people who are strong Democrats, strong Republicans.
Right.
People
you
in the middle.
Get the middle.
So, you know, we're eliminating people who are strongly partisan, eliminating people who have already decided, for better or worse, whichever way they're going,
right.
how they're going to vote on everything.
Right.
So we're looking for people who are a little bit more persuadable, which are harder and harder to get these days.
I bet. Do you ever have to incentivize them by pay them or anything?
Almost always.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Now. Well, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Now, with the campaign, when you can only get one thing through, or they need to focus on one thing, has it always been that way, or is that more of a recent
Well, the environment problem? Is, I was going to say, is we used to cite a study, only coincidentally from my school at the University of Michigan, but talking about how many different ads people saw in a week for everything. In other words, that they're seeing your, and we always say, your campaign, whatever your campaign is, you're not just competing with your Republican opponent, you're competing with Donald Trump, Levi's, you know, everything else.
All the noise out there.
Yes, all the noise out there. And there's, so on one hand, TV is, as everyone keeps saying, you know, less viewership of TV, just true. But there's actually probably more stimulus in many ways. It's just harder to reach people.
Yes.
And that is a problem for polling, but it's definitely a problem for communicating any idea. And one of the things people forget is that as much as whereas I was talking about all the great things we do online, TV still is the best medium to reach people on. That's still the most cost-effective, or I should say, I guess, the cost-effectiveness depends on where you're running, but it's still the broadest reach. It has just gone from dominant where, and I don't know what the number is, but where you'd say, okay, if we're doing TV, we're going to reach, you know, well over half the people. Now it's the best, but it's the best at reaching maybe only, you know, 20% or whatever it would be.
Oh, that's interesting. But yeah. It's still the best way to reach the broadest audience. Okay.
But obviously, and this is not my part of the business, but obviously, you know, ads, people run ads now. If you're doing ads, the call I was on when you came in talking to someone who's doing ads for a campaign I'm on, and you know, it's just given that some of the ads will run online, it is no longer like just a specialized thing. It's just a given that that's one of the places. But I will say the online ads, it's still not like TV, and I would say, and it's about polling too, the intrusive, this is a, from a research standpoint and from a communication standpoint, the things people hate about advertising and about polling, when we interrupt your dinner or, you know, with a call, or when people are watching a show and then, you know, something comes on that they, you know, rather not watch, they want to go back to the show, that intrusion what makes it work. And the fact is, we don't want just people responding to our polls who want to talk at that moment. We're trying to get them at all times. We want to, and again, another change in the industry, we call at more hours of the day because people have cell phones. So it's not like saying, oh yeah, from 9 to 3, no one's going to be there. At least you'll get kids coming home after school. No, it's a different world because everyone's carrying around, not everyone, many people carry around their best way to communicate with you.
Right.
So, and the intrusion is part of it. And I'm saying for communication and research.
Any polling or surveys done via texting?
There are. We have only done experiments with that.
Okay.
Well, you can do, in fact, some of these were done, some I saw recently, not that we had done, people did in the special elections, because it's always a good test ground for this.
Okay.
Because when you're doing special elections, you know, there last year there were specials, and so it's a very important race. It can be a congressional race, but you can try texting. It's been, you know, you can only ask a few questions.
Uh-huh.
This is one of the many reasons live call polls are still the standard, the gold standard, is that you have a human being talking to them, taking them through the material, and it also makes them take it more seriously. And we monitor these calls that are going on as much as they can get long. They're doing that. You're texting them. It's almost the other end. On one hand, it's easier to reach them, and it's very short, but they're just looking at their phone, and they're seeing, like, 2 or 3 things.
Right.
You can only keep them on for, you know, 3 or 4 questions.
Right.
And you can, one of the benefits is, though, you can show them video and use that, and and I'm sure we'll be doing it more and more. You know, as people were I was talking about the broad penetration of cell phones, it's soon, you know, smartphones are taking over, and so everyone will have the ability to, I mean, I say everyone, meaning it's not just a small group of people.
Yep. There'll be a wide audience with smartphones.
Exactly.
Yep.
And so that means not only for research purposes, but it's already happening now with campaigns, though I still am not persuaded it's been effective yet with campaigns. We just did it part of the time in a race in Virginia in 2017, just a year ago. And, you know, we're still not sure how much it really moves numbers, but you can show ads definitely. And we did show ads on
texting.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're texting basically a link. You have a smartphone, you're getting it, and you're watching it.
Okay. So this is your busy season. How many different campaigns are you working on right now?
I actually don't know what the number is. I can't. Yeah, we're talking about, because here we do work for the DCCC, and so that, you know, 10 races we have for them.
Yep.
We do work for both the House and Senate caucus in North Carolina. So we're talking about, you know, tens and 20 there, and then
you mentioned Montana and other.
Yeah, and then Senate races, congressional races, county executive races.
Yeah, so a busy time of year for you.
Yes.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Well, Michael, this has been great. Do you think we covered it? Am I missing anything?
I hear there's one thing I could address. I guess would be the idea of the relation. The work we do with campaigns and bringing that, how that relates to the work we do for companies and organizations. And I'm thinking where I work with Vlad, in fact.
Okay.
Our mutual friend.
Yes.
So
you're talking about Vlad Cartwright at 720 Strategies. who was we did a podcast with him.
I was going to say a podcast a few episodes ago.
Yes.
But you know,
and he's active in all 50 states and what they're doing. And so, go ahead.
You know, a lot of the work we do with someone like Vlad, who's not in the campaign side of this.
Yeah.
But is that we are taking what we do with campaigns and bringing that to whether it's corporations, organizations. That's last couple of things worked with Vlad were industry associations, you know, professional associations that were doing two things, lobbying for certain specific changes in law at both federal and state level, but also doing things where they just wanted to have a better image as the organization itself, the association, that would also help all their members. The campaign world seems in many ways much different than that. The idea is what we're doing with campaigns. It's just a more aggressive and singular focused vision, really, of what any company's doing trying to sell products. Yep. It's just that we only have one buy date. And with early voting, let's say it's now 45 days where they can buy, but there's a limit. So if if we don't make the sale by October, by first Tuesday in November,
it's over for two years or six years or 4 years,
exactly.
Yeah.
And so, but we're doing the same in a way. The research is very similar because what we're trying to find, as I said, is that best message. And whether we're doing that for a corporation trying to persuade someone how to, you know, to buy their product or to think about them a different way or to think about their issue a different way, it still is the same sort of research. It's just that one of the reasons I think people come to folks like us in the campaign world is that it's a very it's where the industry sometimes gets probably more attention than it should, but this idea of the focus that we are trying to get people to do something where it's in a way a tougher sell, because if you're looking at something where they're buying, whether it's a toothbrush or a car, they're going, okay, how can this help me? How much money am I going to spend? Right. Here we've got to get them, make sure they're turning out to vote and feel a certain way about a person who they may have not thought about for the past, maybe ever, and will not think again maybe for another 2 years.
Well, there it is. Michael Bloomfield, smart guy. We really enjoyed that. And I don't know about you, but I learned a few things. And like I said, it's always interesting to listen to pollsters. They're very smart and very helpful. So don't forget to subscribe to the show. You can check us out on Twitter at The Lobbying Show and on Facebook. And you can always, when you subscribe, you can always make comments. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great week. See you next Monday.